You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. My name is John Allen. I'm the president of the Brookings Institution. It's a great pleasure to welcome you today to this public event. It's a very sobering event. It's entitled The Opioid Crisis in America, Prevention, Treatment, and Regulation. Now, while the United States reels from the COVID-19 pandemic, the epidemic of opioid use disorder, or OUD, continues to ravage our country, costing a staggering loss of American lives of nearly 400,000 precious Americans. They've expired, they have died of OUD since 2000. The effects of OUD have devastated communities and cities across the country. In 2018, an estimated 2,350,000 Americans were found to suffer from OUD. Those without treatment, or sometimes even with treatment, often were unable to maintain employment or continue relations with family and friends. And sometimes the substance dependence was so great that they were even subject to criminal prosecution, leading to imprisonment. In turn, the U.S. economy has taken a blow due to the opioid crisis. The U.S. Council of Economic Advisers estimates that the effects of OUD cost the U.S. economy nearly $700 billion in 2018. Further, the opioid epidemic has exposed critical weaknesses in current U.S. drug policy, as well as in existing health and welfare systems available to our lower-income population. Recognizing the urgency of this crisis, Brookings has undertaken a multidisciplinary approach. Drawing from experts from programs across the institution, it is with great pride that we launch our newest series, The Opioid Crisis in America, Domestic and International Dimensions. Under the leadership of our senior fellows, Vonda Felbod-Brown and Carol Graham, this series will convene policy and stakeholders at the local, state, and federal levels, as well as members of the public who are on the front lines of the opioid crisis. Today, alongside a panel of experts moderated by NPR journalists Brian Mann, will be sharing their latest findings on prevention, treatment, and regulation. And to kick off this inaugural event, we are honored to welcome Congressman David Trone as today's keynote speaker. Elected in 2018, Congressman Trone serves as the representative of Maryland's 6th Congressional District, and is a member of the Education and Labor, Foreign Affairs, and Joint Economic Committees, and has been a tireless leader on the opioid crisis. He currently chairs the Bipartisan House Freshman Working Group on Addiction, and last month he was appointed by Speaker Pelosi to serve on the Commission on Combating Synthetic Opioid Crisis Trafficking. Welcome, Congressman. It's a great pleasure and an honor to have you with us today for this crucial conversation. But before I turn the floor over to Congressman Trone, a brief reminder that we are on the record today and we're streaming live. So please feel free to submit your questions to us via email at events@brookings.edu. That's events@brookings.edu, or to use the Twitter hashtag at #opioidcrisis. That's #opioidcrisis. Congressman Trone, sir, the floor is yours.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for inviting me here to speak today. The Brookings Institute is a wonderful resource for having a really substantive conversation today about how we can work together to fight the opioid crisis in America. Some of you, you know, may be aware that I came here through a personal journey, and that connection was through my nephew. My nephew's name was Ian Trone, and he died of a fentanyl overdose on New Year's Eve in 2016, alone in a hotel room. He had been sober and clean for 13 of the last 16 months of his life. Ian suffered from addiction, And I, along with my wife, we worked for over 5 years to try and get him and help him stay sober and clean. I helped him navigate on a weekly basis, sometimes on a daily basis, a confusing system so he could access treatment and recovery services. I witnessed firsthand how we're failing those most in need. So I came to Congress, I left the business world, and the opioid crisis is clearly the number one crisis in America. And COVID is incredibly horrific, but at the same time, we can't let it overshadow what, as you just was said, was 400,000 lives, you know, that we've lost, almost 70,000 a year recently. In order to tackle these problems, we have to look at a combination of three pillars: mental health, addiction, and incarceration. I saw personally how these pillars interact with Ian, and we clearly need to do better. Right after I was sworn into Congress, one of my first actions was to form the Freshman Working Group on Addiction. It's a bipartisan group, 65 members, 35 states. We've come together to lend fresh eyes, together as a team, to fight the addiction crisis in this country. We're committed to addressing this crisis through prevention, treatment, and recovery, and ensuring that community-based care and families are included as part of it. In total, our group has sponsored over 35 bills now to address the challenges related to addiction and mental health. And we're working hard to push these through committee and get them voted on. This is a large number of bills, but we know, as you do, there's no silver bullet to ending this epidemic. And we need to approach the problem from many, many different angles. One big win we've had so far is a bill I introduced, secured $7.5 billion in funding for SOR, State Opioid Response Grants, going out 5 years. So we have consistency of funding. Unfortunately, the bill is stalled in the Senate. I'm working now with Senate Republicans, and I believe we're making some progress, and I'm very hopeful. Another bill I introduced, and I'm particularly excited about, is the Family Support Services for Addiction Act. Legislation establishes a grant program for nonprofit family, communities, and organizations that provide support for families of individuals, because it's not just the person struggling, but it's really impossibly challenging for those of us that are trying to make sense of this disease and lend help when we're so emotionally affected. So often these families get left behind, and I saw that in my own personal experience, so we can help them navigate the path to recovery. I'm also an original sponsor on an important bill with Congresswoman Lori Trahan, the Medication Access and Training Expansion Act. This bill would standardize disorder training to ensure that all prescribers of controlled substances like opioids have baseline knowledge of evidence-based and addiction prevention and treatment. Our Freshman Working Group on Addiction has made progress in bringing attention to this important issue, which is why I was honored, as was mentioned before, to be appointed by Speaker Pelosi to serve on the Commission on Combating Synthetic Opioid Trafficking. I'm looking forward to using that opportunity to explore synthetic opioid production, supply chains, China, Mexico, India, and halting the number of opioids that enter our country. I'm also introducing a bill very shortly that will encourage the State Department to do more to combat synthetic opioids and other drugs coming into this country. In the area of mental health, it's so directly tied to addiction, so connected. We can't tackle them separately. One of the most vital providers of mental health and addiction treatment are the certified community behavioral health centers clinics. Representative Matsui and Senator Stabenow have done phenomenal work. Their bill, the Excellence in Mental Health and Addiction Treatment Act, would provide states that currently participating in certified community behavioral health clinics Medicaid demonstration project with 2 additional years of funding and expand it to 11 additional states. The early data coming back on this is excellent. It's also critical that we ensure mental health care for justice-involved individuals. According to the Bureau of Statistics, 1 in 7 individuals incarcerated in state and local prisons is affected by mental health, and 1 in 4 are self-reporting serious psychological distress in the past 30 days. My Crisis and Stabilization Community Reentry Act would allow law enforcement to partner with mental health providers and provide mental health treatment and crisis stabilization for incarcerated individuals and promote a warm handoff. That's the key. When they leave, we need a warm handoff to community-based centers upon reentry. The bill also seeks to fill an urgent need for justice-impacted individuals in those communities they reenter. COVID-19. While the crisis, opioid crisis, and mental health are huge problems before COVID, this pandemic has only intensified those issues. It's critical in our response to this pandemic, we focus on those needs with substance use disorder and the mental health providers who support them. One of the ways we can do this is the funding in the COVID relief package passed by Congress. The 4 laws that have passed by Congress so far have provided billions of funding to hospitals and healthcare providers for PPE, medical supplies, critical research. But in addition, we have to get adequate funding for mental health, behavioral health services. The CARES Act has $425 million for SAMHSA, including $250 million for the certified community behavioral health clinics and $50 million for suicide prevention programs. We lost 47,000 people last year to suicide. This is a good start, but it's nowhere near enough funding to meet the increased needs caused by the pandemic. I was happy to get the Cures Act passed by the House in May. It contained many of the priorities I spoke with Speaker Pelosi about, including $1 billion for community mental health services block grants, $1.5 billion for substance abuse prevention treatment block grants, and $10 million for National Child Traumatic Stress Network. We also put in a new 988 National Suicide Prevention Hotline. Fortunately, doesn't appear the Senate is moving soon. But that's exactly why we need advocates like you to put pressure on the Senate and push for the HEROES Act to move through. But our ends don't end there. In these packages, I've been pressing leadership to provide supplemental funding for mental health and addiction services programs. We need $38.5 billion for these behavioral health centers. Healthcare providers and organizations that offer behavioral health need more support because of the lost revenue and the increased costs. We're going to continue fighting for this. Thank you for inviting us to speak today and for having this important conversation. It's really critical that you, the experts, work with us on the Hill. We really need your assistance. We need your expertise. In business, I learned early on, the best ideas come from the folks in the field that are dealing day after day after day with the problem. They see the processes that don't work. They feel the urgency. And we really need your help. And I encourage everybody to feel free and plead you to reach out to our office, offer us help, and offer us help with the commission as we get our commission up and running. And we'll have with us on the commission all the top executive members of the administration and eventually a future administration. So we need to keep our eye on the prize, end addiction, and the mental health crisis in America. But thank you. Thank you all very, very much. Thank you very much for your work. I look forward to answering some questions.
Congressman Trone, thank you so much for the excellent opening remarks, their comprehensiveness and forthrightness. And thank you, Congressman, for your extraordinary dedication to this absolutely fundamental issue in the United States and, frankly, increasingly around the world as well. We are thrilled to be able to continue cooperating with your office and the commissions and work in the Congress that you lead. I was very impressed by the range of issues that you touched on in your opening remarks. And I am thrilled to hear their comprehensiveness and also that they resonate with the papers that we are launching today as part of the series. The papers touch on everything from prevention, treatment, regulatory design, state responses, issues such as block grants to states that you spoke about, domestic law enforcement and external law enforcement. And they also focus and highlight particularly vulnerable groups such as women and children, veterans, or U.S. communities that have been subject to declining income, manufacturing, and now also COVID. So I look very much forward to continuing exchange. General Allen was very gracious to mention Carol Graham's and my work and leadership on this, but I also want to highlight all the authors that we brought from other prestigious institutions who are really some of the U.S. top experts. And so it's been extraordinarily gratifying collaborating with them, and I look forward to more sustained engagement with you. If you would please allow me to now probe some of the issues that you raised. And perhaps start with the issue that you highlighted, namely supply of fentanyl from abroad. It's the work of the commission that you that is just being created that you will be heading. China has been the principal source of fentanyl for the United States, and both the Obama and Trump administration worked for many years with China to get China to scheduled to ban the sales and exports of fentanyl class drugs unless special permissions are issued. That legislation came into effect in China last year. The issue now is how China will effectively enforce this new legislation or not. And of course, this is taking place in the context of perhaps the lowest point in U.S.-China relations in decades. Some people speak about the U.S. and China being on the verge of a new Cold War. What, in your view, as you are starting to formulate the commission, is a fruitful way to engage with China now to motivate China to diligently enforce the new regulations?
I think you hit the nail on the head. The key is enforcement. We spoke with Senator Alexander, who May a year ago went over to China. And that's what enabled and put the pressure on China, where they actually went out and called out fentanyl as a scheduled drug. But since then, just what you said, nothing has happened to speak of other than one particular incident. So we need to convince China that it's in their best interest to not be a rogue nation, a Columbia of Asia, supplying drugs and killing 70,000 plus Americans every year. So we worked with Senator Alexander. We're also working with the U.S. Ambassador Terry Branstad to China, who's been really great on this issue and a pleasure to work with. Assistant Secretary of State Brigadier General Stilwell, who's very focused on this. And of course, Jim Carroll, President Trump's drug czar. So I've been working with all three of them to put together a CODEL, a bipartisan CODEL with the executive branch to China, which was to go in May. So we were going to be there, meet with all the officials. We had it rolling. We were also going to Mexico too, of course, because that's key, as you mentioned. But in China, they've got to want to do it. And otherwise, we have no chance. And obviously, our relations, as you said, are at an all-time nadir. So we've got to figure out how to convince them that there's positive publicity, there's no negativity about doing the right thing. But we need to get over there and spend time with them. And we need to figure out how to get over to Mexico, because roughly 50% now of the drug is coming in through precursor chemicals into Mexico, the two Western ports. So we're working with the Mexican government is the plan in those ports to figure out where we can cut off the drugs that comes in. But it's a problem, of course, is fentanyl is used legally and illegally. So we've got to figure out ways to separate that and have a trail the whole way from manufacturing in China to here. But without their cooperation, I'm afraid, we're going to have a tough time. But this is going to be the key for the commission, the international peace, China, and potentially down the road, India, because they're such a huge, you know, petrochemical country. And we're concerned that once things get enforced in one location, it'll bounce somewhere else. So I want to try and get out ahead of the game. Yep, that's it. I'm good.
Well, that's indeed very prescient, because the experience of global narcotics or counter-narcotics policy is, of course, the so-called spillover effects, with success in suppression in one location pushing it elsewhere. And we are already today seeing the establishment of connections between Mexican, large Mexican drug trafficking organization and India as a source of fentanyl precursors and, in fact, synthetic drugs overall. Let me stay a little bit with enforcement and perhaps focus on the domestic side of enforcement, which has been often a difficult dimension, often a troubled dimension of U.S. drug policy. And certainly, we are today in a situation where many people who are incarcerated continue to suffer from opioid use disorder, or for that matter, other substance disorder, but they often cannot access treatment. What is your thinking or the work of the committees that you have been engaged with on the idea of lifting constraints of Medicare to cover drug addiction treatment while people are incarcerated?
Well, we certainly know that prisons are some of the biggest providers of substance use disorder out there, and the treatment just not happening. So Medicaid is a key in expanding that treatment. So we need to absolutely move forward there. And Amy Custer has a bill, you know, on this area, and we're supporting that bill as a co-sponsor. But what's happening in prisons is a failure of not only opioids, but also mental health. They're all tied together. I have seven prisons in my district. So I visited with all the prisons, meet with the wardens, the inmates, the unions, the guards, everybody, try and understand what's going on. And just for example, the area of, you know, MAT. I mean, we absolutely have got to have MAT in the prisons. We largely do not. And the mental health piece, as I recently had a prison at 1,300 inmates, one mental health counselor. It's crazy. But we have to take the money in prisons and pay it forward. We're spending $80 billion a year in prisons, and we're getting the 75% recidivism rate 5 years later. So it's just a revolving door. And the way to stop that door and literally save billions of dollars is to put it forward into education and to opioid substance use disorder treatment, mental health treatment, and put all that on the front end. We've also been meeting with the head of the Bureau of Prisons on the federal side. And that's something that, you know, we're going to continue to meet. And we've been talking to the potential Biden administration about all of these subjects already, so we can help get on the ground floor on forming a real consensus to move forward on substance use, mental health, a real Second Chance Act that makes meaningful reform in our prison system. We made a step 2 years ago, but it was a small, small step. There's just so much more to do there. I've been working with the American Civil Liberties Union on criminal justice reform for over a decade. And it's just such a crucial area that people that don't have a voice are just being totally left behind. You know, why is our country have 25% of the world's prisoners? And we're 4.3% of the world's population. It's an embarrassment. And of course, what's happening now across America is certainly part and parcel of this whole situation. And addiction has to be the disease. It's certainly not a reason to incarcerate somebody. It's just dead wrong.
Well, thank you, sir, for saying those words. I am absolutely thrilled to hear them. And I believe that all of the authors and great colleagues on the project would heartily endorse that, the view that we need to treat substance use disorder, addiction, as an illness and not reason to incarcerate people. And certainly COVID only drives home further the need to very significantly reduce prison populations, incarcerated people in the United States, to reserve incarceration for other types of crimes. And the whole issue of changing the view of substance use disorder toward illness also then raises a whole set of questions, such as medication-assisted treatment that you mentioned, MAT, for some of our viewers who might perhaps not know the term. One of the issues that has been effective in other parts of the world is supervised injection sites. That still remains a controversial issue in the United States. The Department of Justice has been trying to block the capacity of local communities to experiment with supervised injection sites. What is your view on that issue?
Full speed ahead. If we don't try and be innovative, if we don't welcome change, if we don't embrace change and embrace some failure, because we're going to have some failure, but we've got to get out there, we've got to do things. And these injection sites in Europe and Canada have proven very, very incredibly effective. And we'd be fools not to explore this. Harm reduction is the overall key. And that's what these injection sites do. It's crucial that we get Narcan with everyone. Also, I know my staff, we trained on Narcan. And one of our staff members actually had the opportunity to save a life when someone had overdosed. But they had gone through the training, they carried the Narcan. And all these families that are living with folks that have addiction, they've got to have Narcan in their house. I mean, this is an unbelievable drug. And, you know, we've got to embrace that. And of course, MAT is crucial, but injection sites, safe injection sites, is an idea that has come a long time ago, and America needs to get with the program.
Well, Congressman Trone, thank you again so much for your remarks and, more importantly, for your dedication to the issue. For those of us who have worked on drug policy for many decades, it is enormously rewarding to see that reform ideas are being embraced by our representatives, and your leadership in this domain has really been inspiring. As well as enormously gratifying. So thank you so much, sir, and I look very much forward to continue feeding information from the work that we have been doing at Brookings, that we will continue to be doing with Brookings as part of this project with the Brookings team and our stellar external authors, and engaging with you and representatives of both Congress as well as the executive, state levels and local levels in delivering that information.
Fantastic. Thank you for the time, and thank you for all the hard work. I mean, we've all got to pull together as a country. I mean, it's 400,000 folks, and that's affected tens of millions of people. You know, we've got to get our hands around this. We've shown we can pull together as a country on COVID. Well, we ought to be able to pull together as a country on substance use disorder in the same way, same intensity, and we can really make a difference. So thank you. Thank the general. And thank Brookings. Have a great day.
Excellent. Thank you, sir. We are now going to be moving to part two of the webinar that will be hosted by Brian Mann. Brian is a journalist who is now the solely dedicated correspondent of OPR, solely dedicated to opioids. Brian has a long, distinguished career in public radio journalism and journalism in general. And he will be hosting the first set of our authors that have produced papers for us for the project on treatment, prevention, state-level responses, and law enforcement, as well as prevention and the underlying causes. Those papers are now live on the Brookings website, www.brookings.edu / opioid crisis. That's www.brookings.edu / opioid crisis. There is also a paper on domestic law enforcement and further paper on other vulnerable groups and external supply side will be coming out within the next month. There will be also other events and products that we will be launching in that span. Brian, over to you.
Thanks, Wanda, very much. And thanks very much to Brookings for having me as part of this conversation. Just a brief additional word about the work I'm doing for NPR. I have been working, as Wanda mentioned, on opioid issues, specifically litigation, for the last couple of years, and have previously worked on incarceration and its link to drug policy for public radio. One thing that I'm particularly proud of is that NPR has now, in a time that's very difficult for journalism in terms of resourcing, has now committed to a full-time correspondent position looking more broadly at addiction, the science of addiction, the policy responses. And so it's a fascinating time to be involved in this discussion with all of you. And sort of hats off to NPR for recognizing, even in this time when there are so many powerful stories, that this is one that still matters. I'm going to do a brief introduction of the panelists and then turn it over to them for readings of their papers that they're presenting today. But I do want to say again that more about the authors is available. I'm going to give kind of a condensed bio for each individual. And you can also now read their papers, which are published again at www.brookings.edu/opioid crisis. So while you listen, feel free to click over there and follow along. So a brief introduction of each of our panelists today. First, Carol Graham is the Leo Pazvosky Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, a College Park professor at the University of Maryland, and also a senior scientist at Gallup. Her books include Happiness for All, Unequal Lives, and Hopes in Pursuit of the American Dream from Princeton University Press. The Pursuit of Happiness and Economy of Well-Being from Brookings. Also, Happiness Around the World, The Paradox of Happy Peasants and Miserable Millionaires from Oxford University Press. Many of these books published and translated in paperback and in many languages. Graham is author of numerous articles in journals that include Science, the Journal of Economic Behavior and Organization, and also the Journal of Population Economics. and she's received numerous awards and honors, most recently the Pioneer Award from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and a Lifetime Distinguished Scholar Award from the International Society of Quality of Life Studies. Also with us today, Jonathan Calkins, who is H. Guyford Stever University Professor of Operations Research and Public Policy at Heinz College at Carnegie Mellon University. At the Heinz School, he was director of the Masters of Science in Public Policy and Management program and also served as interim associate dean for faculty. Jonathan serves or has served on the editorial boards of numerous publications, including the Journal of Drug Issues, and has refereed for over 85 different journals. And he's also taught decision-making, mathematical, and spreadsheet modeling on four continents to students from over 50 countries, including those at the Heinz School, master's students working in public policy on medical management, biotech management, and healthcare policy. We also have Rosalie Licardo Pacula. She heads the Elizabeth Garrett Chair in Health Policy, Economics, and Law, and is a professor of health policy and management in the USC Saul Price School of Public Policy. She was previously a senior economist at the Rand Corporation, a professor at the Party Rand Graduate School, and served as director of Rand's Bing Center for Health Economics and co-director of the Rand Drug Policy Research Center. Her research over the last 20 years has largely focused on issues related to illegal or imperfect markets, including healthcare, insurance, and illicit drug markets. Most recently, her work has focused on proper measurement and evaluation of opioid and cannabis policies in terms of their impacts on use, misuse, and health. And finally, I want to introduce Bo Kilmer, director of the Rand Drug Policy Research Center and senior policy researcher at the Rand Corporation. His research lies at the intersection of public health and public safety, with special emphasis on crime control, substance use, illicit markets, and public policy. Some of his current projects include analyzing the consequences of cannabis legalization with a special focus on social equity, also evaluating the evidence and arguments made about implementing heroin-assisted treatment and supervised consumption sites around the United States. Bo's publications have appeared in leading journals such as the New England Journal of Medicine and Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and his commentaries have been published by CNN, Los Angeles Times, and the New York Times. So we're going to turn it over to the panelists to give brief kind of highlights of their papers. We're going to start with Carol, and then at the end of their presentations, we'll have a period of questions and answers. I have some questions, and we also have questions already from many of you who are out there in the audience, and feel free to continue sending those questions our way as you have them. And so I'll hand it now over to Carol.
Brian, thank you for the wonderful overall introduction, and really thanks for being with us. Your work is super impressive. So I'm going to talk about the demand side of the crisis, and in particular, despair as a major driver of the crisis. It's quite different from a lot of the other work in the project, but I think it's an important way to think about the root causes of the crisis. And if you think about the U.S., even prior to COVID, we were the only rich country in the world where mortality rates were going up rather than down. And that's not a great marker to have. It's due to premature deaths, deaths of despair among primarily, but not only, less than college educated middle-aged whites. A lot of those deaths have been opioid related. And now that fentanyl has entered the equation and is much more lethal, we're probably gonna see even more of that, suicide and alcohol are other important drivers. So in terms of opioids, the US boasts more opioids per capita than any other country in the world, which is pretty remarkable. But a related puzzle is that more people report to have experienced pain the previous day in the US than in 30 other countries in the world, many of them much less wealthy than we are. There's something to that, and I think you will see that it fits with the rest of the story. So while much of the policy side of the opioid discussions focus on interdiction and supply, not very much focuses on the root causes of despair, which have been with us for a long time and well before the deaths of despair. So my research focuses on despair and also differential resilience across population cohorts in the United States. We've been matching trends in the deaths of despair, premature mortality, from the CDC data sets at the county level with our metrics of well-being and ill-being at the level of individuals, races, and places. And what we find is that our well-being metrics, particularly lack of hope, do a very good job of tracking the trends. But we also find very big differences in resilience, with high levels of optimism and low levels of reported stress among poor minorities and African Americans in particular, juxtaposed against high levels of despair and reported stress and much higher death rates among low-income whites. Remarkably, we find even during COVID, that which has hit the African American population very hard, African Americans still report more optimism and better mental health than whites. Particularly low-income African-Americans compared to low-income whites. Had we been tracking well-being for several decades, we would have found that despair increased many decades before the deaths of despair, and despair increased among less than college-educated males in the late 1970s, about the time that the first decline in manufacturing. So this could have been a warning indicator had we been tracking it regularly. So how did all this start? Well, opioid addiction and deaths are most prevalent where in places where manufacturing and other blue-collar jobs have hollowed out. And also, equally important, the communities that came with the jobs and the manufacturing centers and the towns have also hollowed out. So what we find is that loss of purposeful hope and employment and hope more generally are an important part of the explanations and trends of both addiction and mortality. And again, we find particularly low hope and high levels of despair among less than college educated whites who are most likely to die of these deaths. We also find that of all cohorts in the country, poor whites report the most pain on a daily basis, and rural poor whites report even more pain. Again, very linked. If you do a map of reported pain and a map of the deaths of despair, you find remarkable correlations at the county and state level across the country. But America's divisions were clear well before we were aware of the opioid crisis and deaths of despair. And our well-being metrics show that we really have two Americas. So one group with high levels of hope, future opportunities, investing in those opportunities, and in the end doing quite well. And another America that has very low hope for the future, precarious and insecure lives and jobs, and is much more likely to die of deaths of despair, much more likely to be addicted to opioids. And also, I'm afraid, much more likely to get hit by COVID. We find big differences, as I mentioned, across racial cohorts. Poor Blacks are three times as likely to be higher up on an optimism scale, an 11-point optimism scale, than whites, and Hispanics are somewhere in the middle. Poor Blacks are also much less likely to report stress the previous day than poor whites. We know that objectively that can't be the case. So this is clearly a resilience story. In part, it's due to a history of overcoming disadvantage and discrimination. In part, it's also due to place and communities. So we find that minorities, both African Americans and Hispanics, tend to live in more population dense places. They tend to have extensive support systems, formal and informal, mainly informal, families, churches, communities, that have served them in overcoming obstacles for decades. And this contrasts very starkly with the decline in the blue-collar white communities, which the communities were built around, as I mentioned before, the manufacturing towns, the stable family, the stable jobs. And communities basically unraveled when jobs and families disintegrated. We find now that almost 20% of prime-age white males have dropped out of the labor force. So they are not included in our record low levels of unemployment, at least those before COVID. They just don't enter into the ratio. They're often living in their parents' homes with very little purposeful activity. Time use surveys show that they spend a disproportionate amount of time playing video games. They have high levels of addiction, very bad objective health, and they're also very likely to die of deaths of despair. So enter COVID, and while the focus has been rightly so on the hard hit to urban African-American communities, when it hits rural communities, these cohorts are going to be particularly vulnerable, both due to their high levels of pre-existing conditions like diabetes and smoking and obesity, but also because of their high levels of despair. So very quickly, what can we do policy-wise? Certainly, there hasn't been much policy focused on this demand side, on despair. And there's even less policy focused on understanding differential resilience across populations. Yet we have to learn from it. If we don't address these root causes, the decline of the white working class, of their communities, of social capital and families, and a very inadequate public health care system, which I think other panelists will be talking about, the crisis is not going to go away. And in fact, it's already spilling over into the next generation in very frightening ways. What do we know about teaching hope and resilience? Obviously, that's a longer topic. But just to mention, there are myriad efforts that have been successful, not just in the U.S., but also the U.K., of simple programs that get people out of isolation, improving access to volunteering, to the arts, improving, you know, access to group activities in green spaces. These things don't cost very much, and yet they're tremendously important to getting isolated people out of their homes, out of depression. And they tend to be generalizable and can be taken to scale. But these efforts need federal support to go to scale in the US. They're pockets of success, but not many people know about them, and they have absolutely no federal support. And now with COVID, they're also gonna need technological support. So the social distancing that we need critically to save lives can't stop all the efforts to get people out of isolation. So we're gonna need to rely on technology in innovative ways in the short term. And in the long term, it may be a way to reach even more isolated rural cohorts. So this is a moment, I think, that we really should think more about this. So I'm pretty much out of time. I can obviously answer more questions about these efforts or just the patterns in the question and answer session. But I do think we need to deal with this demand, the despair in our country, if we're going to ever resolve our very, you know, our very many crises of addiction. So thanks, Brian.
Thank you, Carol. It's fascinating. I live and work in rural upstate New York, and a lot of what you're describing really resonates with what I've seen as a journalist here in my communities. All right, Jonathan, we'll pass the microphone to you next.
Thanks, Brian. So Carol was looking at the true root cause of deaths from opioids. In this paper by Keith Humphreys and I, we're looking at underlying cause, but not quite that far back. Let me explain that by analogy. If someone wants to reduce deaths from lung cancer caused by smoking, you certainly are gonna wanna find better ways to treat lung cancer, but you're naturally gonna wanna try to reduce smoking. Likewise, if you wanna try to reduce deaths from opioids, you wanna try to reduce opioid abuse and addiction. It's sort of thinking about the death as a symptom, albeit the ultimate and horrible symptom of this underlying condition of misuse that may have been going on for 10 or 15 years before the death. And this chapter reviews ways of trying to prevent that misuse by reducing supply or reducing demand. Now preventing misuse of opioids is definitely more complicated than reducing smoking. In the first place, some opioid use is medically appropriate and crucial for dealing with pain. And also, there's a complicated interplay between prescription opioids and the illegal or black market opioids. So most of the deaths that are ultimately caused by addiction to prescription opioids happen with quite a delay after the individual has, quote unquote, traded down to heroin or other illegal opioids. So illegal markets, including for fentanyl, are an essential part of the story. And this article explains why the patterns of use and the markets really are very different for opioids. So a lot of what we have learned over the last 4 years about supply and demand side prevention for other substances doesn't carry over. But in a way, that's okay, because a lot of what we've learned about prevention for other substances is frankly disheartening. Prevention is very hard. And fortunately, there are levers available now for opioids that were not available for other substances. Or maybe to put it differently, the fact that the traditional tactics of the past would not be useful for 21st century opioids doesn't mean that the strategy of preventing the underlying addiction in the first place isn't viable. So, you know, the fact that scare tactics didn't work for teenagers with cannabis doesn't mean that there's no value in warning the public that fentanyl really is very dangerous, or reminding them that they need to keep their prescription opioids locked up. So I'll give some examples of this kind of thinking. One is to recognize that illegal fentanyl is often distributed in transactions that are mediated in these darknet web transactions. That was never true for cocaine or methamphetamine. So law enforcement can try to shut down or otherwise take out these websites, which are essential to fentanyl trade, and can do that without a lot of arrests and incarceration. They can even hijack the sites and operate them in a way that destroys confidence in the institution of online transactions. Likewise, there are a lot of ways of squeezing the supply to divert prescription opioids that just weren't relevant for other drugs in the past. But some of that diversion is done by a small number of rogue doctors who write very large numbers of prescriptions. These are essentially drug dealers, and they can be arrested and incarcerated. That will not swamp the criminal justice system because there are not that many of them, and they're much easier to deter than a typical street dealer of heroin. But a lot of the supply of the diverted prescription opioids that cause so much trouble comes not from rogue or criminal clinicians, but from well-meaning, overworked, but undertrained clinicians who just need a little nudge to help change their behavior. One very innovative tactic that proved to have some effect was mailing letters to all the doctors who wrote opioid prescriptions to people who subsequently died of an opioid overdose. Just say, look, this person you treated, you had as a patient, I just want you to know they died. And those letters turn out to have a much bigger impact on behavior than just a generic warning about the country having so and so many 10,000 deaths in general. Other little things like just selling the opioids in blister packs instead of bottles can help reduce the number of inadvertent poisonings. And there are a lot of these programs, some of them are familiar, prescription drug monitoring programs, tamper-resistant versions of the drugs, but a lot of the important opportunities are also at the systemic level. And the Veterans Health Administration is a leader and a model in this regard. And some of these systemic approaches involve pharmacies. When pharmacists counsel patients, that reduces adverse events. Counseling takes time, and time is money, but that is money well spent. Or consider drug take-back programs. Right now, in many communities, there's sort of once-a-year, one-off events. But in other countries, anybody, any day of the year, can bring any drug back to any pharmacy. It's like recycling of the 1970s to recycling today. It used to be that once a year, there'd be some paper drive, collect papers. Now we have curbside recycling, and that institutionalizes it, makes it systemic, and makes it much more effective than once-a-year take-back programs. So in sum, to reduce death, we need to prevent the underlying misuse and opioid use disorder. There are many opportunities for doing that in ways that both reduce supply and demand. There is not a single silver bullet here, but collectively, this package of interventions that are relatively cheap, we believe, can make a very substantial difference. Thanks.
Okay, Jonathan, thank you very much for that. Certainly, as I've read into this topic more, this paper really helped me understand where the physicians and the pharmacists fit into that part of the supply chain here and possible overprescribing in some cases. So really interesting. And I'll have some questions about that in a moment. But next, Rosalie, we're going to hand the microphone to you.
Thank you very much, Brian. And I also want to express my gratitude to you for the work that you do communicating this important research and the community's experiences through NPR. It's able to reach more people, which is able to enact more change. Carol started this webinar talking about demand in general and the root factors. John described some of the ways in which we as a country can enact better prevention. I'm going to speak a little bit about treatment. The paper that Brad Stein and I wrote together was written in an effort to try to shed light on some of the broader strategies that the healthcare system, states have taken through the healthcare system to try to improve access as well as the quality of treatment. We have had for decades a very archaic and largely separate substance abuse treatment system that wasn't well integrated or connected with the healthcare system and thus couldn't provide good chronic care management of what we know to be a chronic disease because of its separation. States have really taken the lead in trying to overcome some of these issues with funding that they've received through the federal government, as well as their own initiatives, to invent new ways of doing this. And states are particularly well suited to do so because they have the authority to regulate not just health insurance, but healthcare providers, licensed healthcare professionals and facilities, and they get to set benchmarks for payment reimbursement through Medicaid policy. And so states are really in a position to adopt a lot of change, and lots of this change has gone under the radar. So mindful of the fact that the opioid use disorder is indeed a chronic relapsing condition, and it needs to be treated in a manner consistent with other chronic diseases like diabetes or even heart disease, we approached in our paper a strategy for thinking about ways that states have been trying to improve treatment by putting policies into three broad categories. The first was strategies that are aimed to increase insurance coverage and payment for substance abuse disorders in general. The second were strategies designed to directly increase the capacity to treat more people. And then the third were strategies that were designed and specifically targeted to improve the quality of care for those in treatment and in recovery. Let me provide a few examples of each of these policies to give you a flavor of what it is that we talk about in the paper. First, in terms of strategies that increase insurance cover and insurance coverage and payment for substance use disorder, people are generally familiar with the federal parity law and many states' parity laws as well, which allowed for addiction treatment to be included in a way that had been previously ignored. Insurance companies were allowed to exclude addiction treatment without these parity laws. And many states have adopted policies that are far more comprehensive than the federal policy mandating comparable treatment for addiction services as for physical health services. In addition to this, you have the expansions in Medicaid, not just in terms of the number of people who meet enrollment criteria through the ACA expansion, but also in terms of covered benefits, now including FDA-approved medications for opioid use disorder treatment, including buprenorphine, as well as methadone, which previously were not covered benefits under Medicaid. In terms of payment, states have been responsible for turning on the reimbursement codes for screening, brief interventions, and referrals to treatment, which enable us to identify those in need of treatment and better connect them to treatment. And then, as I mentioned previously, states have been really taking the lead in raising some of the provider reimbursement rates for patients being treated, particularly with buprenorphine. Increasing payment for this treatment actually encourages and nudges clinicians to actually provide the treatment that's needed. So the second area in which states have been really proactive in adopting strategies is in expanding access to physical treatment, both facilities and providers. Historically, states have had to rely on state block grant funding to try to build new facilities, but they've taken a number of steps in the last decade in particular to expand access to treatment in other ways. In particular, through Section 115 waivers, states are being allowed to treat individuals with substance use disorders in facilities previously deemed or usually deemed to be institutions for mental diseases and off the books, not allowed to be reimbursed for care for people who are being treated largely for substance use disorder. This change is really important because many of these institutions for mental diseases are well prepared to treat the comorbidities that many people suffering with addiction are also struggling with. And it expands immediately the facilities in which people can get treatment. Secondly, states have been pursuing strategies to increase physician uptake of these buprenorphine waivers that are required in order for a provider to treat a patient with buprenorphine. Physicians are required to take an 8-hour course on addiction and then obtain a waiver through the DEA. And this takes time and actually a little bit of money. And so states have been trying to incentivize physicians to do this by providing reimbursement for those for those doctors who do decide to pursue this. And then a third way in which they've been expanding treatment is basically in expanding opioid use treatment in outpatient settings for those in the criminal justice system. And they've done this in a couple of ways. One, states have in their criminal justice laws mandated diversion program for low offending, nonviolent offenders so that they are mandated to treatment in lieu of incarceration. In addition, there are states that are providing medication-assisted therapies to individuals upon release from prison using naltrexone, a 30-day medication-assisted therapy, so that those individuals leaving prison are already on some form of treatment and trying to better connect them to care. A pilot that was done in Rhode Island showed that by simply providing medication-assisted therapy to individuals upon release to prison, reduced the overall state mortality from opioids by 12%. So this is an important population to consider. And then the final area that states have been focused on has really been improving access to quality treatment. It's not enough to just get doctors to prescribe buprenorphine if they aren't connecting patients with necessary wraparound services and therapies needed to fully treat the addiction. States have been doing this by increasing access to the facilities that are better equipped to treat patients with comorbidities. As I mentioned before, the Section 115 waivers that allow for treatment in institutions for mental disorders. States have been piloting a number of initiatives to expand programs that address the challenges faced by primary care providers when they start someone or refer someone to treatment, because they often lack access to behavioral counselors or expert consultation for patients with these disorders. So they have provided pilot funding to develop coordinated care models and enhance the chronic disease management for these patients in particular. And this has facilitated better integration of both behavioral health and the mental health, particularly with primary care. And then finally, states have begun experimenting, a few of them, with pay-for-performance strategies for substance use disorder treatment. And this goes well beyond the global performance-based contracting that has been applied in many areas, because the pay-for-performance actually targets individual physician providers for providing, by giving them higher payment when they provide quality care to their patients. Again, incentivizing, nudging providers to provide the best care possible. So although the transition underway in the treatment system has been slow, it's been very incremental, and it's largely been hidden from the public view in ways that other opioid policy like prescription drug monitoring programs or naloxone laws have not. Thanks to large and sustained investment by the federal government in the past decade and the willingness of states to take this on and lead, there have been a number of sustained efforts and true innovation in our ability to treat patients with opioid addiction. That said, there's far more work to do, and many states still struggle to provide high quality treatment to the large number of people in need. This has likely become an even bigger challenge as many of the public as well as private institutions are faced with budget priority shifts caused by the COVID-19 crisis. And I'll be happy to talk about those perhaps in the Q&A. But it is important as we go forward that we think about how to provide sustained funding for the transition in our healthcare system to better support this integrative care that is critical for addressing those who are currently suffering from opioid use disorder. Thanks.
Thanks, Rosalie. This feels like a really big story to me. It's, you know, as I've covered substance use disorder over the years, it's interesting the degree to which I sort of accepted the siloing of that kind of care from the rest of the healthcare industry, just as a matter of course. And it's certainly something that I've heard people in the healthcare industry talking more about you know, getting more proactive and involved in this. So it's fascinating. Thank you. And Bo, you're up next.
Great. Well, thank you, Brian. Now, I've been collaborating with a number of RAND colleagues to study how other countries have been addressing issues surrounding opioids. Based on this research, I want to share three insights for federal policymakers to consider. The first is that the federal government could invest in clinical trials of medications not currently used in the United States for treating OUD. Now, federal agencies are working together and they're working with private companies to develop drugs, new formulations, and even vaccines to treat OUD. While efforts to spur innovation should continue, there are medications that are being used in other countries that are not currently being used in the United States for these purposes. For example, in at least 7 countries, doctors can prescribe pharmaceutical-grade heroin, diamorphine, to those with opioid use disorder. Now, this is not a first-line treatment, and it's typically targeting those individuals who have been using for a long time. They've tried multiple treatments multiple times, but they're still using heroin. Main goals of this approach are to reduce the use of street source and contaminated heroin and to help stabilize the lives of these individuals. Now, there have been a number of randomized controlled trials where in the treatment condition, you have people that will go to a clinic and inject medical grade heroin, you know, 2-3 times a day, you know, in front of a health official. And there will also be a take-home, there's an option for a take-home dose of oral methadone, you know, to potentially mitigate any withdrawal symptoms. That would be the treatment group. And in the control group, you just have oral methadone. Now, my RAND colleague, Rosanna Smart, spent a lot of time kind of reviewing all these randomized controlled trials. And what she found is that there was strong evidence that those who were randomly assigned to prescription heroin, that they reduced their use of street source heroin, but also found suggestive evidence that that group reduces criminal activity as well as improves some health outcomes. Now, there are other novel treatments for opioid use disorder that could be considered. A less studied option is to prescribe hydromorphone or Dilaudid. Now, a Canadian study found that injectable hydromorphone may be as effective as prescription heroin at improving patient-level outcomes. And since hydromorphone is a Schedule II drug in the United States, there will likely be fewer obstacles to studying this approach. Now, the second insight is that the federal government can make it a lot easier for states and localities to pilot programs to supervise consumption and reduce the risk that an overdose becomes fatal. Now, supervised consumption sites are places where people who use drugs can consume them in the presence of trained staff who monitor for overdose and risky injection practices and intervene when necessary. There are more than 150 of these sites operating in at least 10 countries, and they actually are an important component to Canada's response to opioid-involved overdoses. You know, some offer drug checking services, such as fentanyl test strips, and others provide other, you know, additional services, such as treatment referrals for those who want them. Now, in 2017, the American Medical Association voted to support the development of pilot supervised consumption sites to be conducted in the United States. Despite this call, the Department of Justice has stifled these efforts, arguing that the supervised consumption sites violate the crack house statute of the Controlled Substances Act. Now, the federal government has a lot of options here. One is to pass a law explicitly exempting supervised consumption sites from the Controlled Substances Act and start funding some demonstration programs. Another option would be to pass a budget rider prohibiting federal funds from being used to enforce federal laws against those who are implementing and staffing and using these supervised consumption sites. But you don't have to change any laws to allow local governments to experiment with these sites. The Department of Justice could publish guidance indicating that it will not make enforcement a priority for targeting these sites as long as they're consistent with state and local laws. Additional guidelines could include that when the sites open, that they incorporate a strong evaluation component where you've actually got a credible control group and you've got an independent evaluator. But it's also imperative that we not limit our thinking about supervising consumption to fixed sites. You know, some of them are mobile and there's been a proliferation of less structured and less resource intensive sites in Canada. And there may also be technologies that can make it easier to supervise consumption. And the government could consider, you know, sponsoring some type of XPRIZE competition to help spur more innovation in this space. Then the final insight is that the federal government could support large-scale wastewater testing to detect the use of synthetic opioids and other substances. This is quite common in Europe and Australia, but it's not used very much in the United States. And this type of approach can supplement traditional epidemiological drug indicators, such as drug prevalence and overdose. The information used from wastewater testing could actually be part of an early warning system to alert people who use drugs, as well as health and safety workers, when new substances have entered a local market. You know, for example, in places that aren't yet swamped in synthetic opioids, a spike in fentanyl levels could trigger public messaging about not using alone, or increased deployment of naloxone and fentanyl test strips. But in addition to informing communities and helping them prepare, the data that we actually get from wastewater testing could be very helpful in evaluating the effectiveness of interventions targeting drug use. So in summary, giving those who use drugs the services they need and reducing the probability that an overdose becomes fatal are not just about funding. There are policies, laws, and other barriers that make it harder to achieve these goals. And if policymakers simply treat the current crisis like a typical drug epidemic and do not start thinking creatively, we are going to condemn thousands of people to early deaths. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bo. And to everybody, really interesting start to the conversation. Let me say that we're running a little bit behind right now. And so one of the things, there have been some great questions that have come in. And what I'm going to try to do is kind of condense them into sort of bubbles of ideas. And I'd love to have the panelists respond to these. And let me start with this question. It kind of pivots from what Bo was talking about. How far do you think we are along in the process of segueing from the sort of tough on crime drug policy to something closer to a real treatment solution where we think of substance use disorder as an illness, where we do open the gateway to all kinds of treatment options? Or are we still largely in many states and many parts of the country trapped behind some of these ideas about crime and punishment and the primary role that law enforcement still plays in many of these areas? Anybody want to take a swing at that?
Sure, I will, and I'll be slightly contrarian. I think that we've come a long way. It varies a lot which part of the country. But I actually think it's a little problematic just to say that there are two poles, two options, tough on crime or treatment, and treatment is the solution. We should be very troubled by what happened in Vancouver, British Columbia, which has been the world leader of progressive drug policy, universal health care, fantastic treatment, all harm reduction, and they got clobbered by fentanyl just as hard as West Virginia. And I think that's sort of what Bo was pointing to, is that we need to not only think law enforcement or treatment, we fundamentally need to innovate. This is a different problem than we've ever faced before. Doing treatment is better than law enforcement, but it's not enough. We actually need to innovate.
That's interesting. And one of the things that is interesting is how many of the questions that have come in have voiced a more suspicious or guarded attitude toward the role of law enforcement and courts and incarceration in treating this. So that's interesting pushback there. Anybody else have thoughts about this sort of tension?
I think part of the tension is natural because of how our funding happens. And the fact that it's different agencies that have accountability for understanding outcomes only within their agency, as opposed to overall broader outcomes. There used to be a lot of coordination across agencies through the Office of National Drug Control Policy in previous years. That office has played less of a role. It's now being managed more by the Department of Health and Human Services. And I find that I think these siloed budgets and the focus of these agencies still creates a barrier. Without an overarching agency that cares about driving a shift. I think ONDCP was the agency responsible for enacting the war on drugs. They implemented that mindset very well. And maybe it isn't the right agency for a more treatment-oriented approach. That said, the expertise on how to do it was still there, in that they They looked across the different agencies that are involved in treatment. The criminal justice system is involved in treatment, is doing innovative things in treatment. So is the healthcare system. So is social work. So an agency that can, or an organization that looks beyond budgets and along beyond particular agency metrics, I think would help improve our actual operation as a government in moving towards better, more comprehensive and cohesive efforts to treat this as a health problem.
Thanks for that. Let me go to, and this kind of goes from the budget point that you just made. A lot of folks have asked about the level of concern or fear that in this moment of COVID-19, it will be very, very difficult to maintain what budgets there are for mental health and for substance use disorder treatments. And perhaps it could even sharply reduce resources available in some places. What's the sense of the group in terms of how big this hit could be to the progress that has been made in terms of resourcing some of these better solutions?
Tremendous. John, you want to say something more? I know I interrupt.
Well, you're speaking of reality. In some sense, not necessary, right? In a time of need for fiscal stimulus, we want shovel-ready projects. That's the term, shovel-ready. Well, expanding mental health services could be seen as a shovel-ready project. It could be that expanding in this area could be seen as part and parcel of the response to need to stimulate the economy, not that it has to be what Rosa describes, although I think she probably is speaking of how it will play out.
Yeah, I would just say, I think that the attention right now, even on the private organizations, the hospitals and the healthcare systems, are dealing with the immediate need to get PPE and people able to treat the onslaught of patients that either are experiencing or are about to experience because of the spread of COVID. And so given the allocation of resources to these very, very basic needs, there's a real risk that other services that are also in need, such as the behavioral services and the addiction services, will be ignored just because budgets are limited. In particular, this is an environment where recovery becomes really hard to sustain because of what people are facing in terms of loss of loved ones, loss of jobs, loss of place to live, isolation. And so this is a time where we need to be particularly attuned to these issues and funding behavioral health and addiction services more. But I'm not sure that the resources are going to be there in light of the other immediate needs to treat the disease of COVID-19.
Anyone else have thoughts on that? Let me go to a question that I get a lot when I'm reporting on this issue, and a bunch of the questions that came in sort of go to the broad idea of overreaction, that with the opioid crisis, there is such pressure on limiting the supply, especially through physicians and through prescription writing, that there are people out there who've been harmed by not being able to get treatment if they're in real pain. And so let me, again, kind of bundle this together and see if anyone has a sense for, from the research, your work and data, how big of a problem is this, that people who actually need these medications, in some cases now, can't get them?
Well, I'm sorry to be the one to keep jumping in here, but we actually make an explicit reference of this in the paper that we write, that it is a genuine concern to appropriately provide opioids for pain management for those that are in need, and particularly for those individuals that we have gotten to the point where they are in need to function. But the issues that need to be tackled to address those go far beyond just thinking about this from an addiction standpoint. From a healthcare system standpoint, providing coverage for alternatives to opioid medications for managing pain are an important part, including benefits for things like chiropractic care or other non-medication-based therapies for pain management are important. So again, from a healthcare perspective, there's a lot that we can do and states are beginning to do. A lot more work needs to be done. I think the focus on just restricting supply is dangerous to individuals who have real needs. We need to take a more balanced approach.
Brian, can I jump in for just 2 seconds on this one? I totally agree that that's a risk and a problem, but even historically, minorities have been much less likely to be prescribed opioids. So there, and these links between reported pain and opioid prescription, they're less likely to say they're in pain. So I think it's a complicated issue. There are a lot of people without access to any kind of health insurance that are either going to get these things illegally or not at all. And they may also be in a lot of genuine pain and in need. Again, sort of fitting that problem, but creating a twist to it.
Any other thoughts on this?
I would just add that, it's one thing to be thinking about this at the macro level and in terms of large scale spending on treatment. But when you start thinking about this at the local level, if law enforcement is going to either attempt to restrict prescription opioids or whether it be heroin or fentanyl at the local level, I think this could be really important to begin thinking about, okay, well, what's going to happen to those individuals who don't have access, not just those that were using prescription opioids? That if you think you're going to have a successful effort at maybe drying out the heroin market for a couple of weeks, what's going to happen to those individuals? So it seems like it would make a lot of sense that in those environments, for law enforcement to be working with treatment to make sure that there might be beds available, but then they may increase outreach. So I think it's important to think of this at the macro level, but also at the micro level, there's a lot of coordination that could happen that could end up improving social welfare.
So we've got just a little under 10 minutes left. And so what I'd like to do is go through a bit of a lightning round and ask each of you one final question and just be as brief as you reasonably can, given the time constraints. It's fascinating. I would love to dig in a lot deeper on this. And Bo, let's stay with you. A couple of your suggestions for increasing treatment and reducing fatal overdoses sort of go to the idea of needing better information, arrestee drug abuse monitoring program, the wastewater testing that you mentioned. I guess this leads to this question of just how big an information deficit is there out there right now in terms of, we think about tracking COVID-19, we're testing and testing and getting better or no test. Like, how well right now are we able to actually know what's happening in communities?
We're largely flying blind when it comes to understanding the number of people who are using opioids, and the number of people who have opioid use disorder in this country. You'll typically hear people talk about, there's 2 million or 2.3 million, but those figures are largely based on household surveys. And we know that they miss a lot of your heavy heroin users. For example, in 2016, the National Survey on Drug Use and Health would have estimated that there are probably about 200,000 people in the United States who are daily or near daily heroin users, whereas the numbers that RAND generated for ONDCP put that figure at closer to 1.6 million. So that's the thing you have to kind of keep in mind here, is that most of these estimates you're hearing are way too low, and that makes it hard to have proper planning, also in terms of kind of doing evaluations. And I want to keep this short, but look at RAND, and I've worked with Rosalie and John and many others on this in terms of estimating the size of these markets. Look, it takes a lot of different data. You need information from a lot of different data sources. But by far, the most important data source we have for estimating the total number of people who are using, how much they're spending, total consumption, was the Arrestee Drug Abuse Monitoring Program, which interviewed individuals who were arrested, not only about their drug use, but also their drug market patterns. And this wasn't an expensive program. At its peak, it was operating in 40 counties at about $10 million. And that's one of the key data sets we use to estimate these markets. But that program was cut in 2013. So if you care about monitoring what's happening, a low-hanging fruit here for federal officials would be to bring back some version of the ADAM program. You could also think about adding different modules that other agencies could support. You could have a rotating module on homelessness, one on police contacts, one on firearm use. So there's a lot we could do here that wouldn't cost a lot of money.
Thanks very much. Interesting. Carol, let's jump to you here. And again, being as quick as we can just to get everybody in one last time. Talking about these diseases of despair, especially in white communities where you say that it's clearly elevated, How are sort of traditional organizations responding to this? Unions, churches, you know, farm organizations. Is there any effort there at sort of the grassroots to respond to this crisis?
Well, I think here you have sort of a tragedy in that, you know, the blue collar white population traditionally had, you know, unions and stable families and stable manufacturing jobs, and they all went together in a way, while minorities didn't have access to these things, but created these extensive informal networks of social ties and other coping mechanisms. But unions, for example, in this country have just been decimated, with the exception of a few remaining strong public sector ones. The communities in these same places have also been decimated. If you look at civic engagement and even church attendance over time among less than college educated population in this country, it's been going down over the past two decades. So the things that we most need have also sort of lost their momentum. And I obviously could say more, and I know we have like no time left, so I'll leave it there. Thanks, Brian.
More of a discussion there. Jonathan, let's jump to you. Here's a really quick lightning round question. You talked about nudges and incentives that could convince physicians to prescribe fewer opioids. Is there anything that you've seen in the research you mentioned the letter writing. Any other really good ideas that could sort of curtail the number of pills going out the door right now?
Absolutely. Change the defaults in the electronic medical system. Doctor goes to write a prescription, computer screen pops up with a form, it's pre-filled. One of the pre-fills is how many days? Often it's now 30, change it to 7. That alone has a big effect. And if somebody needs more than 7, it's one mouse click to give it to them. Simple step, big effect.
Interesting. And Rosalie, we'll close with you before we hand it back to Vonda. You talk about breaking down these silos between traditional mainstream healthcare and substance use disorder healthcare that's been over sort of in its own world. Is there resistance from that community? Are the traditional sort of substance use treatment programs and facilities resisting this integration, or has it been fairly positive cooperation? How's that working?
I think they're thrilled to be part of the healthcare discussion, quite honestly, but there's enormous real barriers to them becoming integrated. The primary one being health information systems that cannot just, I mean, they've been focused on setting up systems that can bill and get reimbursed by insurance providers. That's the first stage. But then there's the systems that can then talk to these other healthcare systems and integrate with their electronic healthcare record, which we know from the mainstream healthcare industry has been an enormous challenge, and one that is still a big barrier for optimal integration with these facilities. Some health systems have opted just to purchase the specialty delivery systems to make them integrate more efficiently and effectively, and they incur the cost of bringing them up to speed on the electronic side. But that, I think, is going to be the major barrier.
All right. Thanks very much. Thanks to all of you for taking part. It's been enormously helpful. And as I move forward with my work, I'm going to be pestering all of you a bunch more in the future. So we'll continue the conversation in that way.
Feel free.
And great. Wonderful. It's nice to meet all of you in this way. And Vonda, I'm going to pass it back to you to kind of briefly wrap things up.
Well, thank you, Brian. Thank you for your terrific probing questions and moderating our panel. Thanks to all the panelists. Their papers are now live on the Brookings website, www.brookings/opioid crisis. I also want to acknowledge some of the other colleagues that are either have their papers out and will be featured in other events, or their papers will yet be coming out. And that's Brad Stein, who co-wrote the paper with Rosalie. That's Keith Humphries, who co-wrote the paper with John Coggins, as well as a paper by Bryce Pardo and Peter Reuter on domestic law enforcement, already out. We will hear from them in webinar 2. Also paper by John Hudak on veterans, still forthcoming. And by Paul Weiss, Gia Ahmed, and Joshua Sharfstein, again forthcoming in July. We will be releasing a podcast on the opioid epidemic and its domestic and international dimensions on July 10th. And the second set of the papers and webinar two will take place in at the end of July. Stay tuned. And my thanks go to Representative Trone again for addressing us and for his dedication and commitment to the issue. And finally, thanks to the entire team, to Carol, Bo, Rosalie, John, and all of our other participants, all of our other authors, and again to you, Brian. It's been terrific working with you on this very difficult and crucial issue.